True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Edith Meyer was born on Independence Day, and she soon went by the nickname Pen. It really suited her because Pen was her own person, very independent. At age 55, Pen was living her best life in the small town of Goshen, New Hampshire. She was a recovering alcoholic and known for her helpfulness and her compassion towards others in the program. Join us at the quiet end for One Day at a Time. Sadly, it was Penn's concern for others and her willingness to go out of her way for a friend that led to her untimely death. Over many years of giving counsel to her friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, she was bound to gain some enemies. But Penn would not let that dissuade her from doing what she saw as the right thing. She had an innate sense of right and wrong and a deeply held respect for life, and that's something that her killer lacked. So here comes Dickie with a little bag of beer. What you got in there?
I got a beer that you're going to like quite a bit. It's a fruited sour called Lollipop Forest Strawberry Shortcake.
Just can't go wrong with that name.
No.
No. And it's sour, so sign me up.
So it's brewed by Deciduous Brewing Company, which is a fairly new brewery. Not brand new, but fairly new in Newmarket. And it's a nice little place. This beer, the Strawberry Shortcake version, is pink with a small pink head. It has an aroma of strawberry and lactose, some sugar. A tart strawberry taste. Good beer. Only 6% alcohol by volume. It's nicely tart, but not excessively so. So I know you're going to like this.
I think so. I think for a beginning beer drinker who's only just kind of dabbled in ciders and lighter beers, this might be something to try.
It could be.
It's not hoppy. It's just got a nice flavor, a little sourness.
Yes, and it's not, again, it's not that pucker-up sour.
Well, I like the pucker-up sour, but yeah.
You've been drinking sours for a while.
I'm an old lady. So let's open it up.
Okay.
All right, come on down to the quiet end, and I would like to make a quick apology. We made an error in our recent episode, The Incestuous Wife, where we called Winthrop Winslow. Winthrop Rockefeller, we called him Winslow, I guess, more than once. I didn't notice, but a lot of people did.
I didn't notice either, but
it happens.
It does.
But we apologize for that. I hope it didn't confuse anyone too much. And it's comfy down here. I'm going to let you start us out, Dickie. I find this story very interesting. We're kind of from that area, so that makes it interesting, of course. But Pen just seems like the kind of woman I would have really liked.
You would have hung out with her.
She could have been my friend, yes.
So the last person to speak with Pen Meyer, besides her killer, was her close friend Kathy Buchanan. And this was a phone call that Kathy would never forget. So it's about 7:30 in the morning on February 23rd, 2005. Kathy worked at the Animal Inn, which was a boarding kennel, and it was not a good time to call her. She's trying to get breakfast out for the dogs, and you know how they're going to be. They're barking and whining and moaning and saying, feed me, feed me, feed me.
Loud.
Loud.
Yes.
So Kathy's hauling bags of kibble into the kennel, and the noise was so overwhelming from the dogs that she barely heard the office phone ring. And when she picked it up and saw it was Pen, and she's thinking, well, Pen should know better. It's not a good time for her to call. But she was still happy to hear Pen's voice. The two women attended the same Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and Pen was one of Kathy's most supportive friends. And this was especially true over the past few months, since Kathy had finally decided to break up with her married boyfriend, Ken Carpenter.
Yeah, well, it seems that Carpenter had manipulated Kathy, telling her lies about his marriage being loveless and sexless. And he's not the first one to do that.
Oh, that's a standard ploy.
Standard line, sure. Now, she was a pretty vulnerable woman as well. But then he'd been stalking her since the breakup, to the point where Penn and some other friends were encouraging Kathy to get a restraining order. But now, on the phone, Penn was acting completely out of character. "I can see now I've made a mistake," Penn said. "I want you to go to the courthouse and remove the restraining order against Ken." Now, did Penn actually believe that Kathy should get back together with Ken Carpenter? Well, no, Kathy didn't think so. But Penn continued, "You know he's facing a $200 fine. I never meant for it to go this far. Call him up at Jim's house and tell him that you'll testify for him in court and tell the judge you made a mistake." So Kathy answered, "Penn, are you sure?" But Penn continued, "I'll leave a letter for the court explaining how I pushed you because I was jealous of you and him. Kathy, I am so sorry for my part in all of this. I never planned this. I know that he truly loves you, and I did my best to remove him from your life. I know he loves you, and that is his only crime." Now, maybe if it hadn't been so loud, she could have noticed that there was something off in Penn's voice, but it was so noisy she could barely hear her.
Yeah, but still, the content of what she's saying is just so opposite to what had been happening.
Exactly.
She's got to feel that there's something amiss.
She did. But she's working her job at the time.
Yeah.
Still, like you said, she couldn't believe what Penn was actually saying to her. Penn went on to tell her that she was going to send her a letter explaining all of the ways that she had manipulated Kathy. She apologized again and added, "I'm sorry I used you to make him hurt. It wasn't personal. I just wanted someone to love me that way." Then she told Kathy that she and Carpenter should be together and all should be forgotten.
So as Kathy's continuing to feed her noisy dogs, she's shaking her head in disbelief. Forget about everything that happened? She and Penn had spent months working to separate from Carpenter. A large group of her AA friends had sheltered her away in their homes and broken the anonymity pledge so they could testify for her in court. And despite all of this, Carpenter had continued to pursue her. In fact, he'd been stalking her.
Yes, Kathy was still trying to process what she'd been told. Penn had another surprise for her. She told Kathy she was leaving town and moving to Mexico and South America. Penn said she'd never mentioned it before, but she'd been involved in a love affair with a pilot. But what about Penn's boyfriend, Kathy thought, who Penn loved and who loved Penn? His name was Frank Adams.
Tough luck, Frank.
So Penn went on and on about this pilot. He wanted her to travel the world with him, she said. She said that she was going to let Ken Carpenter house sit while she traveled with the pilot. "If the two of you move in together," she said, "as you should, you can rent the house out and move my garden to your place." So Kathy's pretty shocked. Move in together? Had Penn lost her mind? The Penn she knew would never leave her home and garden behind. And moving in with Ken Carpenter was just about the last thing Kathy wanted to do. Penn's voice did begin to crack, and Kathy noticed that, almost like she was tearing up. She said, "Kathy, you're truly a friend. I only want the best for you. Know this. Go after Ken the way that I had you stay away from him. Think of aloneness as a drink and stick to him like glue. Let him be your Prince Charming." This is so above and beyond craziness.
Yeah, I just would have a very difficult time being Kathy to hear this stuff. It just has nothing at all to do with what they'd been discussing before.
Right.
And they'd been through.
Yeah, so to say the least, she was confused. But like I said, she was distracted by her job. She tried to get Penn to agree to meet during lunch break so they could talk. But Penn went on. She said, "Keep him happy and keep him out of jail." Then she told Kathy that she had given her sheepdog Fluff to Ken Carpenter. Fluff was like a child to Penn, so this made no sense at all. Overall, this call lasted about 10 minutes. Penn mentioned something about Ken Carpenter surviving a serious chainsaw accident, and then it was over. Kathy just stood there for a moment with the phone in her hand before she hung it up and went back to work. But she made a mental note to call Penn that afternoon. But unfortunately, she wouldn't be able to reach her. In fact, nobody would.
So let's talk about Penn Meyer's background a little bit, who she was as a person. She was born Edith Meyer in Boston in 1949 to a large family with old money. She was named after her mother Edith, which became confusing in the household. So Edith began to call her namesake Penny, short for Independence Day, the day she was born. That nickname stuck, and it was later shortened to Penn. Now, the Meyer family had 11 children, and they had the financial means to take care of all of them in style. Her father was a wealthy Boston businessman. The family had several homes. But Penn did not have all fond memories from childhood. In fact, later in her life, she described her childhood as one lived in fear of her domineering father, who was a harsh disciplinarian. So she had a relationship with her family that wasn't ideal. In fact, of all her siblings, she was only close to one sister.
You know, Penn had attended an all-girls school as a teen, the Pingree School in Southampton, Massachusetts. It was a progressive school set up in the family mansion of Charles Pingree. After she graduated, she moved to New London, New Hampshire, where she enrolled in Colby Sawyer College as a liberal arts major, and she graduated in 1970. After her college graduation, Penn married her boyfriend, Colin Campbell. They had three children together, Justin, Kira, and Haley. It was while she was raising her children that Penn began weaving. That would become a big passion of hers. She'd met another housewife, and they decided to learn the art together. Penn took to weaving and seemed to have a real gift. She eventually became known in the New Hampshire art and craft community as a master of weaving. She made a modest living by selling the placemats, napkins, and other household items she created. But making a living was never her main concern, because she did have a generous trust fund from which to draw funds. Plus, she kind of the belief that art should be shared with the public, not put away somewhere in a museum. So it was important to her to sell her things to just regular people.
Sure. In 1985, Penn and Colin were divorced. Penn worked part-time as a gardener and florist at a small farm stand. She and her ex-husband maintained a friendly relationship, but she also made many new friends. She was a woman who lived a comfortable life, but definitely she lived below her means. She enjoyed nature, loved to walk or hike for miles, even in the snow. And one thing Penn became known for were her surprise snow angels.
And this is just really charming to me.
She would quietly make her way around her neighborhood in the winter evenings, leaving snow angels in the yards where children lived. So after a new snowfall, the children would become excited by a snow angel in the yard and would talk about who could have left it.
Yeah, it's a super cute idea.
Yeah.
But Penn was far from perfect, and her life had been far from perfect. She'd been sexually abused as a child, and then she learned to soothe her emotions with alcohol. Not uncommon. But she was able to keep her drinking problem hidden. In fact, none of her family or friends suspected that she was an alcoholic. She was this active, outdoorsy person, and alcoholism didn't fit into the image that people had of her. But then in the 1990s, Penn suffered a nervous breakdown. She was hospitalized and finally faced up to her issues. Then she gave up drinking and she joined Alcoholics Anonymous. She worked really hard to heal the emotional wounds from her childhood sexual abuse. And some would later say that Penn was an overachiever in recovery. She became an advocate for women, especially, seeking sobriety.
In 2001, Penn remarried after her two older children were out of the house. Her new husband, Richard Rankin, turned out to be a very controlling and jealous spouse. He also drank to excess, and he was verbally abusive when he drank. The marriage lasted about 3 years, and then the couple separated. And on her own, Penn purchased a home in Center Road in Goshen, New Hampshire, where she settled in nicely with her dog, Fluff.
And Penn became well known in the small town of Goshen, which had a population of fewer than 1,000 people. She was this petite, energetic woman with long salt and pepper colored hair. Her eyes were a striking gray color, and she dressed in loose, oversized, but high quality clothing. She was also known for her jangling bracelets, which she wore all of the time. She really liked Native American jewelry. Her home was on Gunnison Lake, known in Goshen as the Goshen Ocean. It was lovely, but far from fancy in any way. She drove a modest, late-model Honda. She was an avid gardener. She volunteered for climate change causes and continued her weaving. She believed in sharing those creations with people, selling them for reasonable prices at the local farmers' markets. But maybe her real gift was that she had a sense for when people needed her help, and she gave of it freely. Pen really loved her dog Fluff, and she took him with her pretty much everywhere. She'd taken him to a training course, and when he wasn't allowed into places that Pen visited, he was very well behaved and fine with waiting in her Honda CRV. The farmer's market where she sold her creations was not dog-friendly, but she didn't let that stop her. She would sneak Fluff in and hide him beneath her table. And he also went with her when she swam, hiked, and canoed. Her best friend was Fluff.
And Pen loved her home. It was set at an angle to allow for a lake view out the back. There were grassy hills leading to the waterfront and hiking trails running through the land. She had a room just for her weaving. Now in her 50s, she had a life she loved. A big part of that was her Alcoholics Anonymous community and her friends she worked with for environmental causes. One important aspect of her happiness was that she wasn't afraid to speak out for what she believed in. She was attracted to the emotionally scarred and wounded. Kathy was one of those wounded people, a woman who was being controlled and manipulated by a dangerous man, and it was her brave actions on behalf of Kathy which would lead to her downfall.
Well, on the same morning when Kathy received that strange call from Penn, another friend of Penn's named Joanne was waiting for Penn to pick her up and drive her to a dental appointment. There was no public transportation in Goshen, no Uber, no taxis either. Because Joanne didn't drive, she depended on her friend Penn to take her to her appointments. To Joanne, Penn was her very best friend. Not only did she take her to doctor and dental appointments, but she drove her to their AA meetings. Joanne had turned to Penn for support and guidance after her divorce. She shared her worries about being a single parent with Penn. And most importantly, Penn was very easy to talk to. Penn had convinced Joanne to apply for a job as an executive assistant back when she was working at McDonald's. And Joanne had gotten the job. It had a better salary plus benefits. And Joanne would never have had the confidence to do that without the support of Penn. So Penn meant an awful lot to her.
Absolutely. So at 9:35 in the morning, Penn wasn't there. She was late. So Joanne called her to remind her. No one answered Penn's house. Joanne left a message on her answering machine. It was hard to believe that Penn could have forgotten about the appointment because she had called Joanne the night before just to double-check on the time she was going to pick her up. Joanne tried Penn's house again, now starting to worry that Penn might have been in a car accident. It was February, and the roads were likely to be covered with patches of black ice, which is always fun to drive on.
It is dangerous.
Yes, it is.
So Joanne called around to other friends, inquiring about Penn and looking for someone else to drive her to her dentist appointment. Everyone agreed with Joanne that Penn's no-show was completely out of character for her. She was nothing if not dependable and punctual. Another AA friend took Joanne to her appointment, and when she got back home, there was no return message from Penn. If anything had happened to keep her from picking up Joanne, Penn certainly would have called to explain. So Joanne started looking for Penn again. She called several more people, and she contacted a mutual friend to relay a message to Penn's boyfriend, Frank. That afternoon, Frank was at work when he received a call from another AA friend explaining that Penn had not shown up at Joanne's that morning. Frank had seen Penn the night before. They'd been in an Al-Anon meeting and spent some time together afterwards. Penn had actually asked him to stay over at her place, but he had declined. When he called her that morning, as was his habit, she hadn't answered the phone. He hadn't been worried because he just assumed that she was out walking Fluff, which she did every morning. But Frank called her house again and left a message for her to call him back as soon as she received the message. He had agreed to drive some men to an AWOL, Another Way of Life, meeting in the late afternoon, another support program for addicts. They probably call it AWOL.
Yeah, probably.
So he decided to drive to Penn's house afterwards to check up on her. So let's talk a little bit about Frank.
So Frank grew up in Connecticut. His father was an alcoholic who ended up dying from lung cancer. Growing up in the 60s, Frank didn't know what he wanted to do with his life. He enrolled in a Kentucky college just to avoid the draft. But after his freshman year, he was expelled. He had spent most of his time drinking, picking up girls, and playing bridge for money, and his grades were all failing. So he's out of school, he lost his deferment, and to avoid being drafted into the Marines, Frank joined the Army. He was trained as a combat photographer simply because he had experience developing pictures while he was in high school. Now, he still did see combat, and he ended up taking photos of things that he never wanted to remember. In Vietnam, he began using hard drugs, including heroin, and it would take him decades to find his sobriety.
Yeah, Frank moved from job to job for the next 3 decades. He ran a photo lab, he sold vacuum cleaners door to door, and eventually he sold used cars. He married 4 times, but he never realized that he might be the problem. By 1995, Frank was earning minimum wage working in a warehouse. His 4th wife wanted a divorce, and he'd lost his driver's license and his car. So finally, he accepted that it was his drinking that was causing the repeated failures in his life. So Frank was clean and sober when he met Penn Meyer. He had been working the 12 steps for 10 years by then. He went to meetings regularly, including Al-Anon and AA. He was now a sponsor for some new members of the community. The people at the meetings came from all different backgrounds. There were lawyers, bankers, nurses, and blue-collar workers. What they all had in common was their addictive and compulsive behaviors. And it wasn't only the drugs and alcohol which plagued their lives. Many of them tended to overeat, sleep around, and shop beyond their means. The meetings kept them on track with the program and helped with gaining some control over their lives.
The first time that Frank saw Penn Meyer was at an AA meeting in Newport, New Hampshire. She was poised, and he admired the way she was interacting with people at the meeting. As he worked on his sobriety and decided if he was actually ready to be in a relationship, Frank resisted showing his feelings for Penn. They talked after meetings, and in the winter they began to talk in her car, with Fluff at Penn's side. When Frank was feeling ready, he asked her out, but Penn wouldn't go out with him until her divorce from Richard Rankin was final. So finally, on September 15, 2004, they went on their first date.
Yeah, Penn shared her social and environmental causes with Frank, bringing him along to protests and town meetings. She also shared with him much of her childhood trauma. She told him that when she was just 9 years old, she was attacked by a family member and beaten until she lost consciousness. And the family dog defended her, attacking this relative. For Frank, it explained her empathy for abused people, as well as her love of dogs. So he fell in love with her within weeks, and then they began spending more and more time together.
Yeah, now it's just 5 months later, and Penn was missing. At this point, Frank is beyond being worried. He had a really bad feeling that something horrible had happened to the woman he loved. After going to the AWOL meeting, Frank drove the 2 men who went with him home in his car. He's driving south from Newport back to Goshen, and he asked the guys if they minded if he stopped by his girlfriend's house to check on her.
Yes, it was about 9:30 when Frank pulled into Penn's driveway, and there was a light on inside. Using a remote for her garage door, which Penn had given to him, he saw that her car was still parked inside. So he had the 2 guys wait in his car while he went inside. He didn't want them seeing Penn if she was hurt or sick or something. Now this couple, Penn and Frank, were planning to move in together in the spring, and Penn had already given him a key to her front door. Once inside, he called out for her but got no answer. He walked back to the bedroom and then the bathroom, but she was not there. The house looked pretty normal, except that her bed was unmade. Her answering machine light was on, and he pressed play. And there were several calls from Penn's friend, Joanne, the one she was supposed to pick up. Joanne was concerned because Penn had not shown up and given her a ride, and it wasn't something she would do if she could help it. Then, Frank heard a message that had been left by Kathy.
Kathy's message said, "Call me. I want to talk to you more about the bombshell you dropped this morning." Then there were messages which Frank himself had left. And as he looked up, he heard Fluff walking over to greet him. So Frank thought that the dog looked disappointed that he wasn't Penn. Now Frank couldn't imagine where Penn could be with her car and her dog left behind. And his blood ran cold a little as he realized that someone had taken her from her home. And before he left the house and went back to his car, he just had this real bad feeling of dread. Penn was gone, and he believed that he knew who had taken her, and he needed to talk to Kathy and the police.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that right away he was thinking that someone had taken her, someone in particular. He seemed to put it together quite quickly.
Yes, he did.
Now, Ken Carpenter, we're going to talk a little bit about him. He was born in 1951 in Greenfield, Massachusetts. His father moved from job to job, so they moved around quite a bit. Eventually, the family returned to Massachusetts, and his parents bought two drive-in movie theaters. One was for general popular movies, and another one played Triple X features. As a teen, Ken enjoyed having parents who owned a drive-in. He could see movies for free and get lots of free stuff from the concession stand, too. And once his friends were old enough to drive, he could sneak them in. Being business owners may have given people the idea that the Carpenters were well off, but they definitely weren't. While he was in high school, Ken played football. He made the varsity team as a linebacker and defensive guard. In 1969, he became co-captain of the team. He got a real reputation as a tough player, and a few of his teammates were uncomfortable with the pleasure he seemed to take from making violent tackles and hits.
Yeah, he must have been pretty tough. If he was on the varsity as a linebacker and offensive guard, he's playing both ways, which just isn't done. You either play on the offense or the defense.
But, you know, being in high school and enjoying tackling and hitting other players, that's something that was noted about that guy in Katy, Texas, who was convicted of killing his wife. Do you remember what his name is? No. Okay, but it was someone that Kelly Siegler from Cold Justice had convicted, and there was a lot of drama around that.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just remember that people in his high school thought he was just a little too violent, more violent than he needed to be in the sport.
Yeah. Although, you know, it's kind of a fine line between being aggressive and being violent.
Yeah, I just think if you're playing with someone for a long time and you kind of see that they enjoy it.
Yeah, true.
It might give you a bad feeling. So as an adult, Ken lived most of his years in Massachusetts. He was divorced twice and he had one child, a son. Like his father, he moved from job to job but never established much of a career. And he drank a lot. But then in 1981, Ken stopped drinking. Alcoholics Anonymous was good for him, and he seemed to make his real career being sober. He worked the 12 steps, taking time in meetings to offer support to the newbies. His dedication to his sobriety was admired by others in the program, and he would eventually become a sponsor to other men in AA.
Yeah, Ken did have charisma and confidence in the AA community. He was pretty average looking. Long gray hair with a skimpy ponytail and a thick gray beard. I guess he wasn't too much to look at.
No, but he just had this magnetism to a lot of people that did make him attractive to vulnerable women who saw him as kind of a guide into their sobriety.
Right.
Which is definitely a no-no in AA. You shouldn't be picking up women there.
No, but that's what he did. And once he stopped going to bars and drink, his social life revolved around AA meetings, where he found good, easy pickings.
Seems like it.
Now, he seemed able to pick out vulnerable women, just like a predator picks out the weakest gazelle. During breaks, he would approach the woman he had his eyes on and talk to her. Again, he was an impressive guy, and he seemed to know all the answers to sobriety. He had moved on from getting his thrills from alcohol and drugs to the thrill of getting women to trust him. So for two decades, Ken Carpenter picked up women at AA meetings. But then he found love at a meeting in Nashua, New Hampshire. The woman he fell for was a blonde in her 40s named Cynthia Harvey, and everyone called her Harv for short.
Yeah, Harv was religious, and she wanted to give back to people in her community. She had plans to return to school and become a nurse. She went to church regularly and liked the idea of surrendering to a higher power for her sobriety. She began dating Ken in July of 2000. And it wasn't long before he moved into her place in Nashua. He wasn't as religious as Harv, but he went along with her to church and socialized with the congregation. So it seemed like an okay match. It didn't last long at all.
No. So a year or so after moving in together, Harv and Ken moved to a new place. This was a cottage in rural Leominster, New Hampshire. So that place was much closer to Harv's nursing college. And Harv took a night job working as a nursing assistant in a nursing home while she took classes during the daytime. Ken, though, had difficulty finding a job. particularly with his sketchy work history. For example, he was hired by the town of Newport doing public works, but got dismissed right after he finished the probation period. Then he drove for a concrete company, followed by a few weeks as a shelf stocker at Walmart.
Yeah, he was actually fired from Walmart for shoplifting. He's just kind of horrible.
Well, he's not a go-getter for work.
Well, yeah, but there's a lot more to his horribleness.
Which we'll find out.
Yeah, but the unemployment soon became a real point of contention in his relationship with his wife, Harve.
So in their new community, the couple went to meetings in church basements and community meeting rooms. But the most popular place for AA meetings was Millie's Place in Newport, New Hampshire. This was a clubhouse that had been built for the sole purpose of holding meetings, and it was located in a well-known strip mall. At Millie's, as at other locations, Ken had become known as an inspirational regular, and he began sponsoring members. He and Harve socialized with other couples from AA, and because of Harve's busy work and school schedule, she didn't attend as many meetings as Ken. Still, most of the regulars knew that the two were a couple.
Well, Ken had actually been resistant to getting married again after his two divorces, but he did eventually propose to Harve, and they planned a 2003 wedding. But after living with Ken, Harve did see some red flags. She hesitated for a while. He had a temper, and he could really fly off the handle over just about nothing. Still, Harve did go ahead, and she married Ken.
Because love is going to triumph.
Absolutely. But months of often unemployment by Ken really began to take a toll very early on in the marriage. Not only did he lose jobs, but he also would go out and spend money excessively. He purchased expensive construction equipment, overdrawing on their bank account, and he never earned any money back from it. He got to the point where Harve knew he was either at an AA meeting or he was at home in front of the TV. His favorite shows were the police procedural programs, like Law and Order and CSI.
And so Harve would work Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday nights until 11 o'clock. She wouldn't get home on those nights until close to midnight. Now, this obviously left Ken free to linger after meetings, going for coffee or food, talking to other members, you know, just hanging out. Then in January 2004, Kathy Buchanan showed up at an AA meeting at Millie's. She was trying to get sober, and the people at Millie's were very supportive of her. Now, not even married for a year yet, Ken set his sights on Kathy. Something about her was attractive to him. She was not only an alcoholic, but she suffered from depression. And this, for some reason, intrigued Ken.
Well, I think, yeah, it probably did, because he had depression, and he was an alcoholic. Plus, it probably made her really easy to manipulate, let's be honest.
Well, yeah, that's the underlying thing.
Yes. So I've never seen or met Kathy, but objectively speaking, among people who knew her, she wasn't especially attractive. She had long bangs, which hid her eyes, and she just really lacked confidence. Harve definitely beat her in looks and style, but Ken just liked the challenge of getting a new woman to sleep with him. Dating between AA members is definitely discouraged by the program, even though romances do happen all the time. But in the first year of sobriety, AA members should not date anyone. It's a general rule that newbies need a good year to adjust to their recovery before getting involved in a new relationship. Now, although women usually get a female sponsor, that just makes sense, Ken offered to be Kathy's sponsor right away. Now, Kathy knew that men were not supposed to sponsor women, but she was so charmed by Ken, and she found him very comforting and easy to talk to. Plus, they certainly did have a mutual attraction.
Yeah, and when she asked him about his wedding band, he told her that his marriage was over. He told her that he would soon be asking Harve for a divorce, and it wasn't long after that that he began having an affair with Kathy. But Ken never did get around to asking Harve for a divorce.
Well, Harve and Ken's marriage was far from ideal, but leaving her was not going to make his life any easier. He knew that. He was dependent on her financially, so a divorce just wasn't in his best interest. Besides, with Harve working and going to nursing school, he already had all the freedom he needed. He could continue his affair with Kathy and not worry about getting caught. So it seemed ideal to him.
Yeah, win-win.
So with some smooth talking, Ken was able to convince Kathy that his marriage was over. He told her that he had a place to live with Harve, which was crucial for his continued sobriety. So Kathy said she understood why he had to stay in this loveless marriage. Meanwhile, Harf believed that her husband was committed to their marriage. They hadn't even been married very long. Ken was conning both of them and using both of them, really with no respect for their feelings at all.
So when Ken and Kathy were together, they would go to dinner and movies, but actually spent most of their time together in Kathy's apartment. Ken would wait until Harv left for work, then he would go to Kathy's. They shared long evenings together, watching TV and having sex. Now, their favorite show to watch together was CSI. It was on Thursday nights, which were nights when Harv was at work. And she worked Mondays too, so Kathy and Ken could watch CSI Miami on Monday nights. Then, around 10 or 11, Ken would go back home, and he'd make it appear that he'd been home the whole time. Harv had no idea what he had actually been up to.
So while attending meetings at Millie's, Ken and Kathy didn't reveal that they were romantically involved. If they attended the same meeting, they didn't spend much time together, so no one would know what was going on. While attending meetings at Millie's, Kathy and Penn Meyer became friends. Penn was one who sought out women in emotional pain, and she tried to help them. Penn invited Kathy to hike on her property with her and her dog Fluff. So one morning in late 2004, Kathy did arrive, but she was in Ken's car, and Penn saw the two of them get out and walk the property, disappearing from her view. When they finished walking around the lake, they encountered Penn and Fluff in her backyard. Ken seemed really surprised, and he let go of Kathy's hand. But Penn didn't say anything, and they parted with some friendly waves. Penn actually already knew about the affair. Kathy had confided to her about it that summer. But Penn wasn't going to judge her friend. She hadn't seen Harv and Ken together at AA meetings. Penn worried more about Kathy being in a sexual relationship with a male AA member, and all she did was warn Kathy to be careful.
Yeah, but then she ran into Harv and Ken together at a housewarming party, soon after she'd seen Kathy and Ken on her property. So they were obviously a married couple, and in no way estranged. Harv would lean into her husband, and the couple looked close and happy. So Penn realized pretty quickly that Ken had been leading Kathy on, and that Harv had no idea about his infidelity.
So Ken deliberately got himself alone with Penn at that party, and he begged her not to tell Kathy that she had seen him and Harv at the party. Penn told him that she would not lie for him. As he argued with her, she pointed a finger at his chest and said, "Remember the fifth step. Admit to ourselves and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. You need to see what you're doing and how it's affecting you and those around you. And remember the ninth step. Make direct amends. You need to handle this yourself. You can do whatever you want to your wife, but I won't let you hurt my friend." Then she walked away from Ken. And from that point forward, Penn would be hated and harassed by Ken Carpenter.
So back to the night Frank went to Penn's house and found her missing. Frank then drove one of the two friends home. Then he went to Todd's house, and it's the other friend who was with him. And Todd and his wife agreed with Frank that Penn would not have left on her own without Fluff. So these people all knew something was wrong. And Frank was certain that Ken Carpenter had something to do with it. Nothing was unusual in the home except that someone had been painting the walls. And the friend had been painting in Penn's house. So Frank called the friend and asked her if she had seen Penn at all that day. And she said that she'd only seen the dog at Penn's house the whole day she was there.
Frank didn't want to call Penn's ex-husbands, but he was worried and he had to look for her. Frank had not met either of Penn's exes before, but he called up Richard Rankin first, and that's the one Penn had divorced less than 6 months earlier. But Rankin didn't answer his phone. This was a bit troubling to Frank because Rankin had been abusive to Penn during their marriage. So next he called Colin Campbell, the father of Penn's adult children. Campbell was vice president at a bank and well-liked in the community. When Frank introduced himself on the phone to Campbell, he was friendly but calm, and all he said was, "That doesn't seem like her." So Frank said to him, "This is what we'll do. You call your kids, see if anyone has heard from her or knows anything. I'm going back to her place and wait for her there." So Frank headed back to Penn's house, where he would wait and where he would call the police. When he entered Penn's house for the second time that night, Frank was becoming angry. He knew Penn was gone, and he knew who was responsible. He picked up the phone and called the local police dispatch. None of the local police departments in Sullivan County were staffed at night, so the area was patrolled by the New Hampshire State Police. At 10:48 p.m., a dispatcher finally took his call. He said, "I'm at my girlfriend's house on Center Road in Goshen, and she's been missing all day. No one has seen her. Her car is still here, and her dog is still here." The closest state trooper was in the next county, at least 30 minutes away. As he waited, Frank paced the floor of Penn's kitchen. Penn had been gone all day, and he was more sure than ever that Ken Carpenter had done something to her.
Yeah, Frank had warned Penn about Ken. He blamed himself for not being with her to protect her. He's just feeling like he needed to do something more than just wait for the state trooper. So Frank decided he's going to call Ken Carpenter. But Ken didn't answer, and his phone went to the answering machine, and Frank left a message. "This is Frank. Penn's missing. I know you know what's going on. You have to get back to me." Then he went back to pacing around the house. So he's getting more restless. He picked up the phone and called Ken's house again. He wasn't going to wait for Ken to listen to his messages. He called repeatedly, but didn't leave any more messages. Then he remembered that Kathy Buchanan had left a message on Penn's answering machine, saying something about a bombshell.
"Frank, where's Penn?" Kathy asked him as soon as he called her home. "No one has seen her all day," he told her, going over the events of the day. Then he asked Kathy about the message that she'd left on Penn's machine. It was so odd, Kathy told him, and she explained how Penn had called her at work that morning and said that she should drop her restraining order against Ken Carpenter and get back together with him. Now, this was bad. Frank was stunned. Penn would never say that. Kathy explained more, telling Frank that Penn had said something about a chainsaw accident and Ken having a change of attitude. Penn had also told her to drop her criminal complaint and move in with Ken. Frank knew that Penn would never, ever say such a thing.
The New Hampshire State Police Trooper Marcus Herring arrived at Penn's house in Goshen at 11:24 p.m. He found Frank standing in the driveway and talking on a cordless phone. Frank acknowledged the trooper with a nod, but continued talking on the phone with Kathy. So he began to explain what Kathy had told him, but ended up just handing the phone over to the trooper.
Yeah, Kathy explained to the trooper about Penn's complete turnaround on the subject of her ex-boyfriend, and how Penn had never left behind her home and dog before. Inside of the house, the trooper agreed that there weren't any obvious signs of foul play. Frank showed Penn's workspace to the trooper. Her weaving room was just off the dining room. While walking through, the trooper noticed an orange winter coat that was hanging over the back of a chair. He and Frank sat in the kitchen and talked. The trooper took notes. He wanted to know if Penn had any medical issues, or if she was depressed, and if she would have harmed herself. The trooper asked more about Ken Carpenter then, and why he would be angry with Penn. Frank told him that Ken thinks Penn is the reason Kathy broke up with him. He gave the trooper Ken's phone number, and the trooper used Penn's house phone to call him. Just like earlier with Frank, though, the phone rang and rang and went to the answering machine. Trooper Herring identified himself as a state trooper and asked Ken Carpenter to call the state police barracks in Keene, New Hampshire. So he'd left that message, but then at 11:45, his police radio went off. The dispatcher was sending the trooper to a domestic dispute in the nearby town of Unity, so he had to leave, but he told Frank that he would get back in touch later. Before leaving, he looked in the detached garage and noted that Penn's CRV was still parked there. Not long after the state police trooper left, the phone in Penn's kitchen rang, and Frank answered. It was Cynthia Harvey, Ken's wife Harv, and she was angry. "Frank, why in the hell do you keep calling?"
Frank apologized, and he explained what was going on. And he said, "Your husband has been implicated." Harv told Frank that he needed to leave her and Ken alone because they were dealing with their own issues. And Frank said no, because he knew that Ken was involved in Penn's disappearance. Harv just hung up on him. A little while later, Ken Carpenter called Frank back. "Why are you calling my wife's house and trying to upset her?" he said angrily. Frank said that he was looking for Ken because Penn is missing, and he knew that Ken knew what had happened to her. "I don't appreciate you mentioning my name to the police," Carpenter said. "They've already been here." "Good," Frank said. "I'm surprised they haven't already arrested you." And after a few more angry words, they hung up.
So Frank and his friend Todd spent the night on Penn's floor in her house. They woke up on Thursday, February 24th, by a knock on the door. It was 8 a.m., and when Frank opened the door, two troopers, Penn's three adult children, and her first husband walked in. While he had been driving to that domestic disturbance call the night before, Trooper Herring heard that the dispatcher got a call from Ken Carpenter's wife, who gave them a phone number where Ken could be reached. And they called him, but Ken said he didn't have any idea where Penn Meyer could be. The trooper had also spoken to Kira Campbell, one of Penn's daughters, and she gave the trooper more insight into who Penn was and what her life was like. And Kira told him that her mother was very regimented and predictable. She walked her dog every day. She'd never leave her dog behind. Penn's son, Justin Campbell, told the troopers that his mother had a routine. She walked in the morning and she snowshoed in the afternoon. Fluff was always with her on her outings. He said Penn's recent divorce from Richard Rankin had been quite messy. Rankin had run an adult website for a group called the Bearded Clam Society. Now, while it wasn't exactly pornographic, Penn found the group very demeaning to women and did not approve.
Well, and it probably flirted with pornography.
Oh, yes. So Kira Campbell told the police that she found Frank Adams to be obnoxious, and she thought his actions, like accusing people over the phone, were just out of control. Kira explained to the troopers that she and Penn had actually had an argument about Penn's relationship with Frank right back around Christmas time. So she hadn't spent the holidays with her mother, and they actually hadn't spoken since.
Now, Colin Campbell, their father, confirmed what Justin and Kira had told the police. Although they had been divorced since the kids were little, Colin and Penn had remained friendly. He said they spoke on the phone weekly, and the family members all knew that Penn went to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, but none of them knew exactly why she had identified herself as an alcoholic. They told the police that they suspected Penn's nurturing personality had led her to AA, not for herself, but to help those less fortunate.
Yeah, that sounds like some family denial.
Yes, it does.
I almost find that disrespectful. If she's identified herself to have that problem, you need to believe that. I think it's true that she definitely liked to help people, but I still think that if someone is in recovery, you need to accept that they are in recovery. It's just a little weird to me that they thought that.
Yeah. Well, again, they didn't live with her or anything, right?
Well, no, they were grown up.
Yeah, so they might be relying on maybe some different memories.
Well, of course they're relying on memories, but that's exactly my point, is you need to believe what she says, not just what you see.
Sure.
So Frank did have an alibi, and they were able to verify that. The police told Frank they were going to do a 20-yard perimeter search on Penn's property and look around the house for footprints. He and the family needed to leave the house because it was now considered a crime scene. Kathy Buchanan had confronted Ken Carpenter about his marriage in her apartment 3 days after the housewarming party where Penn had confronted him. It was November 17, 2004, and he came to see Kathy like he always did when Harv was working nights. But this night, Kathy had been told the story of Ken and Harv at the party, and she ended their relationship, telling Ken that she could not put up with the lying or the controlling behavior anymore. So Ken said something to her like, well, believe Penn if you want, but none of what Penn said was true. So Kathy ordered him to leave, which he finally did. Ken could have walked away from the relationship at that point. After all, Kathy hadn't threatened to tell Harv about the affair, so he was free to continue marriage and find someone new to cheat with. Penn was the one he blamed for telling Kathy and ruining their relationship. The next night was Thursday, and Harv left for work as she always did. Ken stayed home, and he had to watch CSI all alone. And it wasn't the same, he thought. Then he was just totally determined to win back Kathy. That night he called her. I just want to talk as friends, he told her. But she yelled at him, we're not friends. Do not call here again.
Then on Friday, November 18th, Ken showed up at Kathy's. She told him to leave. Phone calls didn't stop. Ken would also call her employer, the Animal Inn, and try to talk with her. She told him she didn't want to see him and stopped calling. He called back again and again. He called her at home over the weekend. On Monday, November 21st, 2004, Kathy had a message from Ken on her answering machine. He expected her to have Thanksgiving dinner with him, which she had no intention of doing. She began carrying the phone number of the local police department with her wherever she went, and she was afraid that Ken would show up at her job and make trouble for her.
Yeah, so on that Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, there was a full meeting at Millie's place. Most Alcoholics Anonymous members had the day off of work, so they were able to go to the daytime meeting. Getting together with those in the program around the holidays was very important to the 12 steps. So Penn gave her friend Joanne a ride to Millie's, and Frank met them there. Neither Kathy nor Harv was at this meeting, so Frank thought this was a good opportunity to talk man-to-man with Ken and straighten him out. So as soon as the session ended, Frank approached Ken, and Frank began, "Number one, you're a married man. If your wife doesn't know about this, then you shouldn't be doing it. Number two, you know you can't be hitting on a newcomer in the program. It's a very big no-no." Ken Carpenter's reaction, though, was just to dismiss Frank's words. He spoke as if there was a misunderstanding that could be easily fixed. If only he could just speak to Kathy. Having said all they could to each other, Carpenter turned and left the clubhouse.
So Frank walked the length of the strip mall sidewalk to catch up with Penn and Joanne, who were standing and talking with some other women. Suddenly they heard a car racing closer. And then they turned to see Ken Carpenter's Jeep closing in on them. Then the Jeep stopped, then the door opened and Ken jumped out. "My personal business is none of your business," he hollered, waving his finger at Penn. Everyone stood in shock, watching this angry little man screaming at Penn. "You don't get to tell me how to live my life or tell others either." Penn began to answer him, but he took a step closer and yelled, "You revoke my invitation to dinner? I was supposed to go to Thanksgiving dinner with Kathy." And Penn answered, "I didn't know Kathy had invited you to dinner." And then Ken accused her of setting up Kathy with another man.
Well, Ken had quite a rant, calling them all hypocrites. Then he got back in his Jeep, slammed the door, and spun out of the parking lot. Penn was visibly shaking. In the days following this confrontation, Ken became even more determined to talk to Kathy. He seemed to believe that he just needed to get her alone and talk to her without anyone else interfering. So his anger with Penn grew. He felt like she was interfering. Penn was the one who had disrespected him by telling Kathy about all of his lies. He couldn't understand what motivated her to get involved, so he thought to himself, "She's probably jealous of what we have." And he wrote that in a notebook as he obsessively tried to work through his feelings. On November 28th, Kathy went to Millie's place, and she scanned the parking lot for Ken's vehicle before she entered the meeting. But he didn't come into Millie's until after the meeting was well underway. And Kathy didn't feel like she should just get up and leave and cause a scene, and he'd probably chase after her anyway. So as soon as the meeting broke up, Kathy hurried out the door, but Ken chased after her. She continued to walk away from him, but he would not leave her alone. He continued to call out to her and profess his love. It was kind of ridiculous. She got in her car and started up her engine. She was really becoming afraid of this guy.
Oh, yeah. She can't escape him.
He seems a bit unhinged.
On the night of November 29th, Kathy got two phone calls from Ken, which she ignored. Then he showed up at her door. Kathy called her brother. That's whose property she lived on. He was nearby in the main farmhouse, and she told him that her ex-boyfriend was banging on her door. So Greg Buchanan turned on the porch light before walking out, and as he made his way toward the apartment, he saw Ken Carpenter's Jeep drive down the driveway and leave the property. So Kathy invited her brother inside and explained the history to him, as well as Ken's behavior over the last 2 weeks. While they were sitting there talking, Kathy's phone rang again. She was sure it was Carpenter again. So Greg Buchanan picked up the phone and waited for the caller to ask for his sister. Then he calmly told Carpenter he was not to call again, and he hung up.
So on November 30th, 2004, Ken Carpenter received a phone call from an officer at the Newport Police Department. He told him that Kathy Buchanan did not want any more contact with him. Ken said he felt really badly and then asked, "Can I just call her and apologize?" And the police officer said, "No, no telephone calls, no visits." He said that Kathy had asked that he stay at least 1,000 feet away from her. Less than a week later, Greg Buchanan was puttering around the house when he saw a pair of headlights. There was a vehicle driving very slowly down the road. Buchanan went to the window to get a closer look. He saw a Jeep turn off its headlights and drive down the path toward Kathy's apartment. So Buchanan ran around the back door, but by then the Jeep was driving away. Buchanan walked over to the apartment door to see if the lock had been tampered with, and on the front step he saw that Ken had left a bouquet of flowers for Kathy. So he's not giving up.
He's working hard.
Now remember, this is a guy in his 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little pathetic.
Ken and Carpenter's behavior was concerning for Penn also. The behavior had all been about Kathy, but his anger was aimed at Penn. So Penn contacted the Goshen Police Department. Now, that might be a misnomer since the entire force was just a chief and a part-time officer.
Well, that's true, but they can get support.
Right. But Penn knew that Ken Carpenter had not been given clear boundaries, and there had been no consequences for his behavior. He would continue harassing Kathy, Frank, and anyone else he wanted to at Millie's place. Penn told the officer that she wanted to make him aware of what was going on, and he listened to her, and he agreed to contact Carpenter and give him a clear message.
Kathy left her job at Animal Inn on December 5th, feeling very stressed out and exhausted. She was seeing Ken's face everywhere. After going to the police, she'd felt relieved. It was the first time in weeks that she'd slept soundly through the night. But now she was realizing that the advice of her family and friends just wasn't working. Even the police had not scared him off. As she got to her car that day, she noticed something on her windshield. There was a letter under the windshield wiper, and she recognized the handwriting. It was Ken's. "You did say to write as opposed to stopping by, remember?" he had written. At first, the letter went through a scattering of thoughts and emotions. He begged God to remove his pain and help him not think of hurting himself. Also, he couldn't help but share his grievances against Penn Meyer. He had compulsively written out a script of how he imagined Penn must have discussed him with the police. In his imagination, the police asked Penn if he had threatened her, hit her, but he wrote that Penn had said no to those questions. So in his version of events, even Penn supported his claims that he was unfairly accused. So later in the letter, he sarcastically referred to Penn as Kathy's savior. So this was a rambling letter, several pages long.
Yeah, you read that letter and you think, something's not right with this guy's mental function.
No, he was definitely obsessed with the whole situation.
Ken used the anonymity of AA to complain about Kathy's brother, giving him a warning to back off, and then he proceeded to list all the unfair actions that had moved Kathy away from him. He added that Penn had made her involvement personal, and he shamed Kathy for allowing Penn to be her friend. He ended the letter with an appeal for them to sit down together and talk as friends. He even suggested using a local pastor and brother of an AA member, whom Carpenter was sponsoring, as a mediator.
So it's kind of the weirdest thing, because he's obsessed and wants her back, but there's not any thought given to that he might leave his wife at all.
Right.
He just wants things the way they were.
Exactly.
Which is pretty crazy. So the next day after that, Ken returned to Greg Buchanan's property in the middle of the day, when he knew that everyone would be out. He walked up to the door of Kathy's apartment with a letter. This letter opened with just some chit-chat, and then it moved on to declaring his strong emotions for Kathy. But then, after just a few paragraphs, his anger at Penn again became his focus. He portrayed Penn as jealous of the love Kathy received, and that Penn wished he was chasing after her instead of Kathy. He called her the Great Penn, a selfish force of nature, and he ended this letter by begging Kathy to talk to him. So Kathy's truly afraid at this point. He's clearly obsessed and has no intention of moving on without her.
Doesn't seem that way, does it?
Not at all. As she drove to work the following morning, she passed his Jeep coming up her driveway. She had to turn her car around him, and she raced straight to the Animal Inn. She turned her car around him and drove straight to the Animal Inn. Later on, she met some friends after the AA meeting at Millie's. and they agreed that she needed to feel safe at Millie's place if she was going to be successful with her sobriety. They told her to get a restraining order. The fear of arrest might be the only thing that could stop the stalking. In New Hampshire, violating a domestic violence petition is a criminal matter, but seeking a domestic violence petition is a civil one. She would have to go before a judge herself and convince him or her that she was in danger. Penn, Frank, and another fellow AA member offered to speak on her behalf. Kathy went home and got all the letters Ken Carpenter had sent to her or left at her house. On Thursday, December 8, 2004, she consulted with a free legal advocate who helped her file the paperwork. The Newport District Court issued a temporary restraining order that same day, but a full hearing on continuing the order for 1 year was scheduled for 4 days later.
Ken Carpenter sat and waited for his wife to come home on the Friday night. He was due to appear in court on Monday, and if an order was issued, there would be no way for him to keep his secret from Harv. And if the restraining order included Millie's place and included AA meetings, she's bound to find out about it. So this angered him again, because he saw Millie's as his home turf, and he'd have to find a new place for meetings to maintain his sobriety. Harv returned to find her husband sitting at the kitchen table, looking sad and defeated. "Harv," he said, "we have to talk."
So later that same night, Ken Carpenter called Harv's best friend. "Harv's on his way over to your house," he told her. "I just told her that I had an affair and she's very upset." When the car pulled in and Harv ran up to her friend's door, she was waiting for her with a hug and a sympathetic ear. Harv was crying and soon moved into a burst of anger. "He's been screwing around on me with Kathy all this time. I don't know my life at all. I don't know my own husband at all." Harv went on to say that Ken had a court hearing on Monday. If his mistress got a restraining order, it would keep him out of Millie's and threaten his recovery. Both women felt that Kathy was plain and fragile, and that her issues went deeper than just addiction. They sat for a long time together as Harv prayed for guidance. By the end of the night, Harv made this decision. She was going to return home and win her husband's love back. She was going to reclaim her marriage. And, as a religious woman, she prayed to God for strength.
And then, the next day, Saturday, Ken and Harv were at Millie's place for an AA meeting. And during the meeting, Harv couldn't say much without bursting into tears. Carpenter told the group, "I am partly the cause of my wife's pain." And Harv glared at him, just really pissed off that he wasn't accepting full responsibility for his actions. So something must have gotten to him, because he later admitted that he was the cause in full for Harv's pain.
I think the only thing that got to him is he wanted a place to live and someone to feed him and take care of him, to be honest.
You don't like old Ken either, do you?
Nope, nothing to like. The next night was Sunday, and Ken and Harv returned to Millie's place. Penn was there, but she didn't try and talk to the couple. Harv's eyes were red, and she had trouble talking without sobbing. She sat in a chair while her husband got coffee and chatted up around the room. Then Ken tapped a female member on her shoulder and said he wanted to talk to her. This woman had been Kathy's sponsor since she joined AA, and Ken knew that she had influence over Kathy, but only outside of Penn's circle of friends. "I need you to call Kathy for me," he said. "Tell her I want her more than anything." The woman was just disgusted. Harv had just been there crying. She couldn't believe his nerve, and of course she was not going to call Kathy for him.
No.
At this Sunday meeting, just hours before he was to appear in court to defend himself at the restraining order hearing and answer a stalking charge, Ken couldn't keep his mouth shut. And when the floor was open to discussion at the meeting, he said, "My life sucks, and it's not getting any better. I don't know why somebody would tell my wife things that would only hurt her." And he stared directly at Penn, who sat a few seats over. "Why do people have to get involved in my personal affairs?" he went on. "They don't know what my life is like. They don't understand me." So this was seen as pretty out of line. There were many members who got up and left the meeting, feeling very uncomfortable. AA discussions aren't supposed to be specific and personal, and definitely not angry like that. But Ken Carpenter didn't care. He just continued to rant, as Penn stayed in her seat, visibly shaken.
So Monday, for the hearing, Kathy, Penn, Frank, and two other AA members were at the hearing. December 13th, 2004 was the date. Ken entered the courtroom with Cynthia Harvey beside him. They were going to give up their anonymity in the AA program to testify about their relationships. So Kathy Buchanan versus Ken Carpenter began as the judge asked Kathy to tell the court the grounds for her stalking petition. Kathy listed the times when Ken Carpenter had stalked her since their breakup, less than a month earlier. The judge took a lot of notes, making sure he got everything straight, before asking Ken Carpenter if he had anything to add.
So Ken stood up and he said that he'd like to express his apologies to his family, his in-laws, and his friends. He said, "Also, I'm sorry for any disappointment or hurt I may have caused my wife in this outrageous, selfish, shameful act of breaking my wife's trust in total disregard of my marriage vows." Now, this was more responsibility than he had taken for his actions, other than in the previous AA meetings. He went on to say, "I never loved the plaintiff, nor have I ever intended to leave my wife for the plaintiff." Carpenter went on to tell the judge that his attempts to talk to Kathy were motivated only by his desire to apologize to her. He said his phone messages had gone unreturned, and each time he tried to make amends in person, Kathy would run away. He said that a Newport police officer had told him that letters didn't count as having physical contact with the plaintiff. So he portrayed himself as just this misunderstood guy, a victim, really, whose only crime was having concern for Kathy.
Penn testified that she went to the Goshen police to alert them to Carpenter's behavior. She believed he had crossed a line, but police had told her that she didn't have grounds to file a petition. Then when Penn returned to her seat, Ken Carpenter jumped out of his chair. He went on and on about how Penn was out to get him because she was envious and someone who always needed a cause.
Yeah, but fortunately, the judge wasn't buying this. He cut him off. He asked the participants to keep their comments limited to the stalking order. Frank Adams testified about the incident after Thanksgiving. Kathy's sponsor said Carpenter had been showing up at her workplace trying to get messages to Kathy. When the judge asked Ken if he wanted to respond to the remarks, he again blamed Penn. Harv testified for her husband and told the judge that he needed his meetings at Millie's in order to maintain his sobriety. So she was willing to put up with quite a bit for him.
Sure was.
The judge told Carpenter the stalking order would remain in place for one full year. He said Kathy could withdraw the order early if she wished. The order would expire after 1 year unless she petitioned the court for an extension. The order prohibited all communication and in-person contact. The judge clarified that the current order was only a civil order, and he told Ken, "I believe you could have been subject to a harassment charge, which is a criminal charge. But that isn't the case here. This is a civil order. You're not being convicted of any criminal offenses. It may be inconvenient, but you should have heeded the warnings that came from everyone long before you got to court. I don't think anybody has any sympathy for you, certainly not this court. You've brought this situation on yourself." Then the judge handed the order to the court clerk and walked out.
So let's go back to the time of Penn's disappearance. New Hampshire State Police Trooper Jay Almstrom and his partner sat in his cruiser with the lights off as they watched for one of Ken Carpenter's vehicles. They had spent all of February 24, 2005, looking for Penn Meyer. Now they were sitting in the parking lot of the South Congregational Church in New London, watching the door. They knew Ken attended the 7 p.m. AA meeting. His pickup truck pulled into the lot, a silver Nissan that they had seen earlier that day when they were at his home in Leominster.
Yes, so apparently Ken and Harv had three vehicles. They had the Jeep, the pickup, and a purple Escort, which was an unusual color, and it made it noteworthy when someone saw his Escort near Penn's house on the day she disappeared.
Right.
Yes.
It's a noticeable car.
Absolutely. But they also think that he drove the Escort because Harv usually drove that, and it wouldn't be as easily identified as his. But anyway, he was walking down the sidewalk when two uniformed troopers approached him. And he appeared very nervous and stressed out. He said, "I really need this meeting right now." so the troopers weren't there to arrest him, so they could only ask him to cooperate. The AA meeting was only about a half an hour, and Ken promised he would meet them at the police station afterwards.
Yeah, earlier that day, after they'd interviewed Ken at his home, investigators continued their search for Penn. The lead investigator wanted to fill in Penn's timeline from February 23rd. So they began by tracking down the man that Penn had hired to plow her driveway. He told them he hadn't noticed anything unusual when he'd driven over before dawn. He also said he'd never seen Penn without her dog. They also spoke to the painter who was working in the house. She'd known Penn for about 15 years through AA. She had recently started up her painting business, and Penn had hired her to do a bedroom in her home. So on Tuesday, February 22nd, 2005, the painter came over with her co-worker, and they worked on the room until noontime. Penn had an appointment to drive someone early the next morning, her friend Joanne, and she said that she wouldn't be home when they arrived to finish the job, but she'd leave the door unlocked for them. And the painter saw Penn later that same day at an AA meeting, and she seemed fine. The next day, Wednesday, February 23rd, the painters arrived at 9 a.m., the door was unlocked, and no one was home. The garage door was closed, and the CRV was still there. Penn's bed was unmade. This was unusual because Penn always made her bed. It was also unusual that Penn would have left without Fluff, who had been there alone when they got there. And while they were there, Penn had not returned home.
After the judge had approved that restraining order against Ken, Harv thought that her husband would give up pursuing Kathy, and then they could start working on their marriage. But they'd both found that difficult. Harv questioned her husband about his relationship with Kathy. She wanted to know if he was breaking the court order and still trying to see her. Now, she knew that Ken kept journals. He would write about his daily meditations and keep track of things that he found challenging. Now, she'd always encouraged that, but she'd never read the journals. But then one day, Ken went to his drawer and pulled out a notebook and told her she could read it and maybe it would help her understand him better. Harv found the entries in this journal that detailed encounters between her husband and Kathy. So wasn't it odd that he asked her to read it?
Yeah, why?
I think he enjoyed it. That's all I can think. Because Kathy and Ken had gone for walks in the woods, gone to the movies, had dinner in restaurants, and these were things he never did with Harv.
Probably things that Harv would have liked to have done with him.
Exactly. So Harv was not happy, and Ken had to move out of her place in late January and stay with a friend who had an extra room. So that was about a month before Penn disappeared that he moved out of Harv's house.
On Monday, February 28, 2005, detectives took affidavits to a district court judge in Newport to get search warrants. They finally had enough to get a search warrant for Ken Carpenter's home in Leominster. Around 9 p.m., in the middle of a snowstorm, troopers arrived at the Carpenter home. There was no sign of Penn Meyer there, but they did find something significant in a fire pit outside. The pit had been dug out of the ground and was surrounded by cement cinder blocks. The fire pit's contents were still warm and smoldering. The top was covered by small branches and bits of newspaper. So the investigators started pulling out individual branches and examining them. Once all of the sticks and paper had been removed, there was white and gray bits of ash and particulate matter. The first layer of debris was loose, and it wasn't long before they saw the first piece of bone, which was about an inch long. They didn't know for sure it was Penn, but they moved forward under that suspicion. More bone pieces were found, then a piece of eyeglass frames. One thing near the fire pit that looked out of place was a stick, straight up in the thick snow. The stick was about 5 feet long. The bottom part was charred and worn to a point, and it had been left an arm's length away. It looked as if it had been used to stoke the fire.
Well, most of the evidence collected in Leominster was sent to the state crime lab in Concord for analysis. Other items were delivered to the major crimes unit. Then more journals were found in the home. Looking through them, it was clear that Carpenter had spent days devising his plan to get rid of Penn Meyer. Under Penn's persona, he wrote, "Never will you find someone so caring and loving as Ken. I wanted him to love me like that." It's very twisted.
It is.
And at times, he seemed to be troubleshooting, like when he wrote, "Big fire outside stove, where'd she go? Travel? Visit someone sick? Just disappeared." Next in the notebook were more scripts for Penn to read to Kathy in that phone call. Then he wrote, in and out and simple, prior to leaving, tell friends, don't worry, I need my time away. So this plan also called for getting the addresses of Penn's friends and family and sending them cards. He also had plans to open bank accounts to pay her mortgage and other bills. So this was very plotted.
Yeah, he's really thinking it out.
He also made a special note to keep Frank Adams away, Penn's boyfriend.
The police received an anonymous tip from a man who told them he had dropped Penn at the airport back in February so she could go off with a new boyfriend. He said he had proof of this. He told the police that he had hidden a key by the Goshen General Store near the payphone. When investigators went to look, they found a key in a baggie taped under the payphone with orange duct tape. But records showed that Penn had not opened the box in a year. They immediately believed it was Ken who had called. The trooper who spoke to him even recognized the voice as Ken's voice.
Yeah, back at Ken's house, they found a property transfer form signed over by Penn to Ken. They also found a script of the phone call Penn had made to Kathy. But they wondered, how did he get Penn to make that call? He had to have threatened her into signing the forms and calling Kathy. Then they found a drawing. It was stick figures showing one person shooting another. Then in his shed, they found a .22 rifle hidden under some things. When the police looked at the CCTV footage at the general store, they saw it was Ken Carpenter that was there. Now, they didn't have direct footage of him putting the key there, but he'd been there at the time, so it was quite obvious.
It must have been him.
Yes. With the journals, the scripts, the bullet, the safety deposit box key, and that fire pit evidence, the police were able to arrest Ken Carpenter for Penn's murder.
By the spring of 2005, there was increasing pressure on investigators to find more evidence against Ken Carpenter. The medical examiner's office still would not issue a certificate pronouncing Penn Meyer dead. After the probable cause hearing, the next step was to bring the case to a grand jury, but no one on the team knew if they had enough to get an indictment. Now, the grand jury met just once a month, and at some point, the public defender would bring forward a motion to either indict or release. The evidence in the investigation wasn't as solid as the prosecutors would like. And behind closed doors and discussions with police investigators, there were concerns. The medical examiner had not issued a death certificate. Having her incinerated bones discovered on his property was damning in and of itself.
I would say so.
But how do they know it's Penn's bones?
Well, they don't yet, but just finding pieces of bone in someone's yard does not look good.
No, it doesn't.
Of course it needs to be followed up on, but it's a good clue.
And they also had the written property agreements, duct tape, and a bloodstained towel.
Yeah, they found orange duct tape that matched that tape under the phone. I think that's pretty strong evidence.
That's good. Detectives spent days at the medical examiner's office, sifting through more than 60 gallons of ash and debris from the fire pit. They were finding bits of bone, which were sent to the forensic anthropologist for further analysis. If he shot her, the only way to prove it would be to find a bone with a bullet hole in it. If he fatally stabbed her, there could be blade marks on the bone. But all the bones they found were in pieces. They began to believe there might be more than one burn site.
Well, there kind of had to be because there wasn't a whole human in there. Not to be too graphic, but the bones they were finding there was nowhere near the remains of a full human.
Right.
So then on Saturday, June 25th, 2005, Harv brought up the issue of the bones while she was visiting Ken in jail. The grand jury had met earlier in June, but no indictment against Carpenter had been announced. There was still no death certificate for Penn either. So Ken tried to ignore all of Harv's questions, because he was denying having anything to do with this. So he told her, when I get home, I'll walk you all over our property, and I'll tell you all about it. He drew a map of their yard and asked her to do something for him. He was innocent, he said, but he wanted her to get rid of some evidence for him. So that makes no sense.
None. So when she got home from that visit, Harv followed the path on the map. She didn't want to go where it led, but finally her curiosity got the best of her. It was early evening, still some light in the sky, when she walked across the grass to the edge of the tree line. There was an old elm there that had been cut down with a chainsaw, so it was nothing but a stump, and the stump was rotted inside. Harve looked down into the tree and found nothing. Resting in a spot beside the old stump, Harve saw an uneven mound of black dirt, and the dirt on the ground was not bark or sawdust or dirt. It was burned debris, and there were other shapes in the pile. Harve picked up one of several rounded semicircles, and it had a hard metallic consistency she could feel between her fingers. It was a piece of jewelry. She reached for another, and this one was wider. It had turned gray and had flecks of rust. It had once been a bangle. She reached for another piece, but this one felt different in her hand. It was thin, it had been broken, and it struck her then what it was a bone. Many other gray bits were scattered out around the stump. Harve collapsed on the ground by the remains, crying, because she knew that she had found Penn Meyer's remains.
Yeah, Harve first called her pastor, and they prayed together. And he told her to call the police, so she called the state police. And she told the sergeant on duty that she'd found additional evidence in the case. So he said he'd send a car over. When police were finally there and began to search through the remains, the bits of jewelry were very obvious to them. They were still intact. There were some flat pieces recognizable as skull bone there as well. The investigators had been looking for Penn since late February, when this tree stump had been buried underneath snow. The fire pit had yielded just a small fraction of Penn's remains. After collecting the remains and the jewelry, the detectives returned to the inside of the home to talk with Harve, whose face was blotched and red from all the crying she was doing.
I can imagine.
So Harve told a detective that Ken had told her he had dragged a burn barrel out of the fire and that it had made drag marks. He brought it to about 80 feet from the house and dumped it out there. Ken had told his wife that he remembered seeing what he thought was a bone shaped like a horseshoe inside of that barrel. Harve said that her husband had talked about it some more during the jail visit, and he had laughed at rumors in the press that he had cut up Penn's body because he couldn't stand the sight of blood. Harve then said that she wasn't going to look at the stump when she came home, but she just couldn't help herself. When asked about the location of this barrel, Harve said it had been crushed, but it was still on their property. They did find that crushed barrel, and they found a .22 bullet stuck in the bottom of it.
Huh. So the next time Harve spoke to her husband, she told him what she had found, and that she had called the police. As you might imagine, Ken went ballistic. But then Harve told him that God would take care of everything, and she did the right thing.
Well, she did do the right thing.
Yes, she did.
Which is good, because she had burned some of his journals and done some other things, which kind of helped him cover it up. But I really do believe when she did that, she really thought he was innocent. Because once she found this, she didn't protect him.
Yeah, Penn's remains were identified by her jewelry and teeth. Several teeth had been found with the skull fragments. So prosecutors were now pretty confident that they'd get a conviction. A year after Ken Carpenter's arrest, the forensic anthropologist was able to reconstruct Penn's skull. And behind the left ear, she found a perfectly round hole consistent with a bullet hole. They were not able to confirm that Penn had been shot with Carpenter's gun, but it was enough to secure a conviction. Ken Carpenter went on trial in September 2007. On October 11th, he was found guilty of first-degree murder and incineration of a body. And he was sentenced to life in prison without parole.
So based on all the evidence and the testimony, police believe that they know what happened on the morning of Wednesday, February 23rd, 2005. They believe that Ken showed up at Penn's house while she was out walking her dog, that he took her hostage at gunpoint, forcing her to sign over the house to him. Then he made her call Kathy and read from his script. He was really trying to make it look like Penn was leaving the area and giving away her property to Ken and Kathy, where they could live happily ever after. And then, when Penn was of no further use to him, he shot her, he dismembered her, and he burned her remains. True evil.
He's a scum.
Yes, absolutely. Penn is remembered as an incredible woman by her family, friends, and former AA members. They will never forget her. She was a very active environmentalist, and she loved the outdoors. She was also a member of the Friends of Mount Sunapee, and the Appalachian Mountain Club. So her murder was completely senseless. It was cruel. And we know that he planned it over a long amount of time.
He put in a lot of effort.
He absolutely did. Horrible. TCB's music is written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you have comments, a case suggestion, or a good beer recommendation, you can send us an email at truecrimebrewery@tigrabber.com. You can go to our website, too, and write your comments for us there. Or, even better, leave us a voicemail. Your voicemail may be played on an upcoming episode, and we'd love to hear from you. There is a link in our show notes where you can click on that and record your voicemail. And there's also a little widget in the upper right corner at tigrabber.com where you can click and record your voicemail directly on your computer or device. If you'd like to get your future TCB episodes commercial-free, get an extra members-only episode each and every month, plus you'll get access to the 50 or 60, I haven't kept track, members-only episodes that are in our premium feed. You'll get a gift sent to you as well and a thank you note signed by me. Whoop-de-doo. So also, we do have a shop where you can shop for things with TCB logos, shirts, cups, whatever there is. And you can see those things at tigrabber.com/shop. Now I see Dick digging through a big box of stuff. Must be feedback.
It's a big box of feedback. And I have the usual two voicemails and one email. So the first voicemail is from Bex, who is popular with us lately. I think there's three voicemails she's got. This is the oldest one.
Hey, Dick and Jill. This is Bex from New Hampshire, just calling with a case suggestion for you today. I'm looking forward to your 2020 podcast. I bet you already have enough ideas for the whole year. But here's one more. I was reading about Lauren Giddings. It was recently the 10-year anniversary of her murder. Lauren was a law school student and the first person in her family to go to college. So she had just graduated law school. She was studying for the bar exam in Macon, Georgia, and she was 27 years old. She also had just celebrated the marriage of her sister, Caitlin, and she unplugged from everything to study for the bar. And then I believe her family stopped hearing from her, and days and days and days went by. So that's when they became suspicious. And I'll let you read up on the rest of the story. If you want any resources, let me know, any links. But thanks again for the great podcast and looking forward to this year. Bye.
Thank you, Bex. We appreciate you very much. I don't know if that's our dog's toys or Bex's dogs, but I heard some dog toys in the background.
He's chewing on a bone.
Oh, it's Gomez. Okay. It's our Gomez. I apologize.
Yeah, he found a bone he was happy with somewhere. Yeah, and Bex also, listening to her beginning of her voicemail, she's a New Hampshire person.
Yeah.
So I hope she
New Englander
likes the case we just did.
Yes, that's true. Maybe she's heard of it.
Probably,
yeah. Thank you, Bex. We'll look into that. Okay, we have another voicemail, and the other voicemail's from Lindsay.
Yes, Lindsay's from Scotland.
Oh, I love it.
So she'll have a good story.
All right, let's listen.
Hi, Jill and Dick. My name's Lindsay. I'm calling you from Scotland. I live in a little town just outside Glasgow. I've been listening to the podcast now for, several years, and I love it. It's always very homely, and it's one of my staples for listening to podcasts, true crime podcasts. Anyway, I know you don't like all that. The case that I was going to suggest was, I watched a documentary on this case the other day. It's on a channel called ITV here in the UK, and it's called The Speedboat Killer. And basically, I'd never heard of this case. It was just really been just within the last 5-6 years. And it was about the death of a girl called Charlotte Brown. And the perpetrator was a guy called, I think it was Jack Shepherd. Anyway, he caused her death on the first night they met. It was her first date. and he was living a sort of playboy lifestyle. Thought he was it, full of himself, and he basically took this speedboat down the Thames on the 8th of December. So freezing conditions, and they didn't have life jackets on, and they'd been drinking alcohol. So it was a really interesting case. It doesn't centre around just what happened. There's a lot of what happens after that as well. He flees the country, and his trial goes ahead with him basically remotely while he has fled to another country. And it's really interesting as he gets new lawyers there, and it was actually quite big news and on a few different channels, so I'm sure you'll have a lot to look into it with. And I thought it would just be an interesting case for your listeners, as it was really quite interesting to me. There's a lot to unpack. So yeah, hope if you manage to do that, everyone enjoys it, and it was nice to finally do a voicemail for you. So all the best. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Lindsay, for calling in with your voicemail. We appreciate it.
Yeah, this was an interesting crime. The papers played it up as a Tinder date that went bad.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently they had an alcohol-fueled lunch, and then he wanted her to take her for a ride on his boat on the River Thames. And then apparently it was going at a good clip, and it hit a log and flipped. And Charlotte Brown, the date, drowned. Jack Shepherd survived. Apparently he found out he was going to be charged, so he fled the country. He was convicted of manslaughter in absentia and sentenced to 6 years in prison. And he eventually turned himself in to the authorities, so he's in prison right now, although he won't be too much longer in prison.
Well, no, because this happened in 2015.
Right.
So depending on when they finally got a hold of him.
Yeah, I think it was 2018, somewhere around there.
Okay. So. Sounds like maybe a case of a privileged guy. Just guessing. Could be. So that's a shame, but I think it could be interesting how the trial went on and everything. So I'm definitely going to read about that.
Well, and I'm just looking up, as Lindsay said, there's lots of info, and I found a couple sources. So I don't think we'll have any problem finding out details of the case.
Great.
So thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you, Lindsay. Okay, let's do one email. So this email is from Amy. It's a case suggestion. Amy writes, "Hey guys, hope you all doing well. I love the show, and as a beer drinker, I appreciate the beer info that Dr. Dick gives. I have learned a lot about my favorite beverage. Plus, Jill never holds back with her opinion. The banter between you both is fabulous. I had a recommendation for an episode. It's the story of the murdering nurse, Janine Jones of San Antonio. I would love to hear y'all's take on the system that allowed her to get away with so many murders of small children. If you need to find a beer from the area to pair, let me know and I can ship to y'all." Well, we might just take you up on that, Amy. I hope you meant it.
You know, we might do that.
So what do we know about this case? I'd never heard of it.
No.
It's right in Texas.
San Antonio. That's also a little ways ago. It's like late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, I like the older ones. I think there can be a lot interesting in those.
Yeah, and we haven't done a mass murdering nurse or doctor for a while.
No, so we haven't.
She was convicted of two murders, but apparently could have killed upwards of 60 infants.
And these were children.
Children, right. And she used digoxin, she used succinylcholine, insulin.
Jeez.
Yeah, and there's enough villains to go around. The first hospital she was working at, where she started plying her trade, rather than investigating or thinking they might get lawsuits, they just fired all the nurses in the ICU.
Well, that's not the proper way to handle it, but there is a bit of brilliance to that. Because if you get rid of the whole barrel...
Well, that's how they looked at it.
Yeah.
And there's some other interesting stuff, so I think that'd be a good case to do.
I think so. I think it's been a while since we've done any medical ones that I can think of. Recently, so.
Yeah, not recently. I know we talked about doing Dr. Dunch.
Yeah.
But that's going to be later in the year.
Yeah, it's just been done a lot lately, so I want to let that rest and rise for a while. Yeah,
cool down, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think that's a great idea.
Well,
so
there you
have
it.
Thank you, Amy. We appreciate you as well, like we appreciate all our listeners. but we give bonus points to people who call in and leave a voicemail. You know, we're going to have to come up with some kind of contest for voicemail people or some benefit for it. I feel like now that we're down to every other week, I have more time to do fun stuff like that. So stay posted.
So contest coming up.
I hope so. Anyone has any ideas about it or prizes for the contest, please let us know. We do really like to get input from our listeners. Anything else to add, Dickie?
I'm good. I think I'll finish my strawberry shortcake and we can head out of here.
Yes, it is a very good beer, by the way.
It's really good.
Very, very good. I'm glad that we have more because I'm going to drink more, I think. I was afraid it might be too sweet, but it's really not.
Nope.
Nope, not at all.
Good one.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. And we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
We've got some seats ready for it.
Absolutely.
Come on down.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.